Macmillan Audio presents A Mighty Fortress by David Weber. Read for you by Jason Culp. September, Year of God 890. 1. Lizard Herd Square, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant.
So I don't know about you people, but I've had more than enough of this dragon shit,
Patrick Henry shouted from his improvised speaker's perch on the municipal fire brigade cistern.
Bastards!
A voice came back out of the small crowd gathered outside the tavern. It was early in the morning, on a Wednesday, and like every other tavern on the face of Safehold, all the taverns of the city of Manchir were closed and would stay that way until after morning mass. The sun was barely up, the narrow streets were still caverns of shadow, but the clouds overhead already promised rain by afternoon, and the humidity was high. As Henry noted, were tempers. It wasn't a huge crowd. In fact, it was considerably smaller than the one he'd hoped for, and probably at least half the men in it were there more out of curiosity than commitment. But the ones who were committed...
Fucking murderers! Someone else snarled back.
Henry nodded vigorously, hard enough to make sure everyone in his angry audience could recognize the gesture. He was a silversmith by trade, not an actor or an orator, and certainly not a priest. But over the last few 5 days, he'd had the opportunity to profit by the experience and advice of quite a few men who were trained priests. He'd learned how voice projection and spontaneous body language could support and emphasize a message, especially when that message was backed by genuine, burning outrage.
Yes, he shouted back to the last speaker. Damned right, they're murderers, unless you want to believe that lying bastard Caleb.
He flung up his hands in eloquent contempt.
Of course he didn't do it. Why, what possible motive could he have had to order Prince Hector's murder?
A fresh chorus of outrage, this time formed of pure anger rather than anything as artificial as words, answered him. And he smiled savagely.
Goddamned butchers! Yet another voice shouted. Priest killers! Heretics! Remember Faraid!
Yes,
he nodded his head again, just as vigorously as before.
They can say what they want, this new archbishop of ours and his bishops, but I'm not so sure you aren't right about Caleb's precious Church of Caris. Maybe there are some priests who've abused their offices. No one wants to believe that. I don't want to, do you? But remember what Archbishop Willem said in his report about the Faraid massacre. There's no doubt Caleb lied about how terrible the original attack was, and it's for damn sure he and all his other bootlickers have been lying about how restrained their response to it was. But even so, Mother Church herself acknowledged that the priests who were hanged impiously with no proper church trial by Archbishop Michael's own brother, mind you, were guilty of wrongdoing. Mother Church said that, and the Grand Vicar imposed a personal penance on the Grand Inquisitor himself for letting it happen. Does that sound to you like Mother Church can't be trusted? Like we can't rely on her to deal with abuses and corruption? Like the only answer is to defy God's own church? Cast down the vicarate Langhorn himself ordained?
There was another snarl of fury, yet this one, Henry noted, was less fiery than the one before. He was a bit disappointed by that, but not really surprised. Coruscantians, by and large, had never felt directly threatened by the policies of the Church of God Awaiting and the Knights of the Temple Lands. Certainly not the way Carisians had felt when they discovered their entire kingdom had been condemned to fire and the sword by that same church. or at least by the men who controlled it. Still, it would have been inaccurate and foolish to pretend there weren't plenty of Coruscantians who had their own reservations about the church's current rulership. Manchir was a long way from the temple or the city of Zion, after all, and Coruscantians as a whole were undoubtedly more independent-minded in matters of religion than the Inquisition or the vicarate at large would truly have approved. For that matter, plenty of Coruscantians had had sons or brothers or fathers killed in the Battle of Darkos Sound, and it was common knowledge that Darkos Sound had been the disastrous consequence of a war which had seen Coruscant and its allies conscripted to act as the Church's proxies. Among those for whom religious fervor and orthodoxy were major motivators, they burned with a blinding, white-hot passion that surpassed all others. The majority of Coruscantians, however, were far less passionate about those particular concerns. Their opposition to the Church of Carus stemmed far more from the fact that it was the Church of Carus, linked in their own minds with the House of Armagh's conquest of their princedom, than from any outraged sense of orthodoxy. For that matter, Coruscant undoubtedly harbored its own share of the reform-minded, and they might well find themselves actively attracted to the breakaway church. "Best not to dwell too heavily on the heresy, Patrick," Henry told himself. "Leave the ones already on fire over that to burn for themselves. Father Adrian's right about that. They'll be hot enough without you. Spend your sparks on other tinder." "I've no doubt God and Langhorne and the Archangel Schuler will deal with that in time," he said out loud. "That's God's business and Mother Church's, and I'll leave it to them. But what happens outside the church, what happens in Coruscant or here on the streets of Manchir, that's man's business, our business. A man's got to know what it is he stands for, and when he knows, he has to truly stand, not just wave his hands about and wish things were different." The last word came out in a semi-falsetto sneer, and he felt the fresh anger frothing up. "Hector!" a wiry man with a badly scarred left cheek shouted. Henry couldn't see him, but he recognized the voice easily enough. He should have, after all. Ron Amale had been one of his senior apprentices before the Carizian invasion ruined Henry's once-thriving business, along with so many other of the besieged capital's enterprises. And Henry had been there when a cracked mold and a splash of molten silver produced the scar on Amale's cheek. "Hector!" Amale repeated now. "Hector!"
"Hector! Hector!"
Other voices took up the shout, and this time Henry's smile could have been a slash lizard's.
"Well," he shouted then, "there's a hell of a lot more of us than there are of them, when all's said. And I don't know about you, but I'm not ready, yet, to assume that all of our knights and great men and members of Parliament are ready to suck up to Caleb like this so-called Regency Council. Maybe all they really need is a little indication that some of the rest of us aren't ready to do that either."
"Hector! Hector!"
Sergeant Edvard Weston grimaced as the crowd streamed closer and its chant rose in both volume and anger. It was easy enough to make out the words, despite the majestic, measured tolling of the cathedral's bells coming from so close at hand. Of course, one reason it might have been so easy for him to recognize that chant was that, unfortunately, he'd already heard quite a few other chants very much like it over the last few 5 days.
"And it's not anything I'm not going to be hearing a lot more of over the next few 5 days, neither," he thought grimly.
The sergeant, one of the scout snipers assigned to the 1st Battalion, 3rd Brigade, Imperial Carizian Marines, lay prone on the roof, gazing up along the narrow street below his perch. The crowd flowing down that street, through the shadows between the buildings, still seemed touched by just a bit of hesitancy. The anger was genuine enough, and he didn't doubt they'd started out in the full fire of their outrage. But now they could see the cathedral's dome and steeples rising before them. The notion of registering their unhappiness was no longer focused on some future event. It was almost here now, and that could have unpleasant consequences for some of them.
"Still in all, I'm not thinking this is one as'll just blow over with only a little wind. There's rain in this one, and some thunder too, like as not."
His intent eyes swept slowly, steadily across the men and boys shaking their fists and hurling imprecations in the direction of the rifle-armed men formed up in front of Manchir Cathedral in the traditional dark blue tunics and light blue trousers of the Carizian Marines. Those Marines formed a watchful line, a barrier between the shouters and another crowd, this one much quieter, moving quickly, as it flowed up the steps behind them. So far, none of the sporadic, spontaneous demonstrations had intruded upon the cathedral or its grounds. Wayston was actually surprised it hadn't happened already, given the ready-made rallying point the heretical Church of Carus offered the people out to organize resistance to the Carizian occupation. Maybe there'd been even more religious discontent in Coruscant than the sergeant would have thought before the invasion. And maybe it was just that even the most belligerent rioter hesitated to trespass on the sanctity of Mother Church.
"And maybe this crowd's feeling a little more adventurous than the last few have," he thought grimly. "Traitors!"
The shout managed to cut through the rhythmic chant of the assassinated Coruscantian prince's name.
"Murderers! Assassins!
Get out! Get the hell out! And take your murdering bastard of an emperor with you! Hector! Hector!"
The volume increased still further, difficult as that was to achieve, and the crowd began to flow forward once again with more assurance, as if its own bellowed imprecations were burning away any last-minute hesitation.
"I could wish General Garvey had his own men down here," Wayston reflected. "If this goes as bad as I think it could."
A group of armsmen in the white and orange colors of the Archbishop's Guard marched steadily down the street towards the cathedral, and the volume of the shouts ratcheted still higher as those same protesters caught sight of the white cassock and the white cockaded priest's cap with its broad orange ribbon at the heart of the guardsman's formation.
"Heretic! Traitor!" someone screamed. "Langhorne knows his own, and so does Shan Wei!" "Perfect," Wayston thought disgustedly. "Couldn't have come in the back way, could he now? Don't be daft, Edward. Of course he couldn't. Not today of all days." He shook his head. "Oh, isn't this going to be fun?"
Down at street level, Lieutenant Brad Tallis, the youthful commanding officer of 2nd Platoon, Alpha Company, found himself thinking very much the same thoughts as the veteran sergeant perched above him. In fact, he was thinking them with even more emphasis, given his closer proximity to the steadily swelling mob, and his greater responsibility for dealing with it.
"I can't say I'm liking this all that much, sir,"
Platoon Sergeant Jacques McGee muttered. The platoon sergeant was half again Tallis's age, and he'd first enlisted in the Royal Carizian Marines when he was all of 15 years old. He'd been a lot of places and seen a lot of things since then, or, as he was occasionally wont to put it,
"met a lot of interesting people and killed 'em,"
and he'd learned his trade thoroughly along the way. That normally made him a reassuring presence, but at the moment his face wore that focused, intent on the business in hand expression of an experienced non-com, looking at a situation which offered all sorts of possibilities, none of them good. He'd been careful to keep his voice low enough only Tallis could possibly have heard him, and the lieutenant shrugged.
"I don't much care for it myself," he admitted in the same quiet voice,
more than a little surprised by how steady he'd managed to keep it. "If you have any suggestions about how to magically convince all these idiots to just disappear, I'm certainly open to them, Sergeant." Despite the situation, McGee snorted. He rather liked his young lieutenant, and whatever else, the boy had steady nerves. Which probably had something to do with why he'd been selected by Major Porter, Alpha Company's CO, for his current assignment. And McGee's, of course.
"Now somehow, sir, I can't seem to come up with a way to do that just this very minute. Let me ponder on it, and I'll get back to you."
"Good. In the meantime, though, keep your eye on that group over there, by the lamppost." Tallis flicked one hand in an unobtrusive gesture, indicating the small knot of men he had in mind. "I've been watching them. Most of these idiots look like the sort of idlers and riffraff who could have just sort of turned up, but not those fellows." McGee considered the cluster of Coruscantians Tallis had singled out, and decided the lieutenant had a point. Those men weren't in the crowd's front ranks, but they weren't at the rear either, and they seemed oddly cohesive, as if they were their own little group, not really part of the main crowd. Yet they were watching the men about them intensely, with a sort of focus that was different from anyone else's, and some of those other men were watching them right back, almost as if they were waiting for something. Or anticipating it, maybe. The cluster of church armsmen was closer now, Wayston observed, and the quantity of abuse coming from the crowd swelled steadily. It couldn't get a whole lot louder, but it was getting more inclusive as shouts and curses with a clear, definitely religious content added themselves to the ongoing chant of Prince Hector's name.
"All right, lads," the sergeant said calmly to the rest of the squad of scout snipers on the roof with him. "Check your priming, but no one so much as moves an eyelash without I give the order."
A quiet chorus of acknowledgement came back to him, and he grunted in approval, but he never took his eyes from the street below him. Despite his injunction, he wasn't concerned by any itchy trigger fingers, really. All of his Marines were veterans, and all of them had been there when Major Porter made his instructions perfectly, one might almost have said painfully, clear. The last thing anyone wanted was for Carizian Marines to open fire on an unarmed crowd of civilians in the streets of Coruscant's capital. Well, maybe that was the next-to-last thing, actually. Wayston was pretty sure that letting anything unfortunate happen to Archbishop Claremont would be even less desirable. That, after all, was what Wayston's squad had been put up here to prevent.
"Of course, unless we're ready to start shooting anyone as soon as they get in range of him, it's possible we might just be a tad late when it comes to the preventing part," he thought with profound disgust.
"Blasphemers!"
Charles Dobbins shouted, waving his fist at the oncoming Archbishop's guard. His voice cracked. It still had an irritating tendency to do that at stressful moments, and his eyes glittered with excitement. Truth to tell, Charles didn't really feel all that strongly one way or the other about this Church of Carus nonsense. In fact, he hadn't chosen his own war cry. That had been suggested by his older brother's friend, Ron Amale. And he wasn't the only person using it either. At least a dozen others in the crowd, most of them no older than Charles himself, had begun shouting the same word, just as they'd rehearsed, the moment someone caught sight of Archbishop Claremont's approach. From the way some of the people around them were reacting, Ron had been right on the mark when he explained how effective the charge of blasphemy would be. Personally, Charles wasn't even entirely certain exactly what blasphemy was, except for the way his mother had always clouted him over the ear for it whenever he took Langhorne's name in vain. And he had no idea how the Church of Carus's doctrine might be at odds with that of the rest of the church. He was no priest, that was for sure, and he knew it. But even he found it difficult to believe the more spectacular stories about orgies on altars and child sacrifice. Stood to reason that nobody could get away with that right here in the cathedral without everyone knowing it was happening, and he'd yet to meet anyone who'd actually seen it, or anyone he would have trusted to tell him whether or not it was raining, at any rate. As far as the rest of it went, though, for all he knew, this new church of theirs could have a point. If even a quarter of what some folks were saying about the so-called Group of Four was true, he supposed he could understand why some people could be upset with them. But that didn't matter either. They were the vicars, and so far as Charles could see, what the vicars said went. He certainly wasn't going to argue with them. If someone else wanted to, that was their affair, and he knew quite a few Coruscantians seemed to agree with the Carisians. In fact, at this particular moment, there were a shanway of a lot more people inside the cathedral than there were standing outside it shouting at them. For that matter, Charles's own mother was the housekeeper for the rectory at St. Catherine's. He knew where she was this morning, and from what she'd said in the last few 5 days, Father Timon seemed to be leaning heavily towards this new Church of Carus as well. But that was really beside the point, as far as Charles was concerned. In most ways, he shared his mother's immense respect for Father Timon. Yet, in this case, she was missing the true point. No, the true point, or at least the one which had brought Charles here this morning, wasn't doctrine or who wore the archbishop's priest's cap here in Manchir. Or it wouldn't have been about who wore the cap, except for the fact that the man who did had sworn fealty to the Empire of Carus, as well as the Church of Carus, in order to get it. It wasn't so much that Charles was a fanatic Coruscantian patriot. There really weren't all that many Coruscantian patriots, in the sense that someone from the millennium-dead Terran Federation might have understood the term. Loyalties in most Safeholdian realms, there were exceptions, like Carus and the Republic of Siddermark, tended to be purely local. Loyalties to a specific baron or earl or duke, perhaps. Or to a prince or an individual monarch. But not to the concept of a nation in the sense of a genuine self-aware nation-state. Young Charles, for example, thought of himself first as a Manchurian, a resident of the city of that name, and then as, in descending order of importance, a subject of the Duke of Manchir, and as a subject of Prince Hector, who happened to be Duke of Manchir, as well as Prince of Coruscant. Beyond that, Charles had never really thought all that deeply, before the Carisian invasion, about where his loyalties lay, or about relations between Coruscant and the Kingdom of Carus. In fact, he still wasn't entirely clear on exactly what had provoked open warfare between Coruscant and Carus. On the other hand, he was only 16 Safeholdian years old, 14 and a half in the years of long-dead Terra, and he was accustomed to being less than fully clear on quite a few issues. What he did know was that Coruscant had been invaded, that the city in which he lived had been placed under siege, that the Coruscantian army had been soundly defeated, and that Prince Hector, the one clearly visible, from his perspective at any rate, symbol of Coruscantian unity and identity, had been assassinated. That was enough to upset anyone, wasn't it? Still, he'd have been inclined to leave well enough alone, keep his own head down, and hope for the best, if it had been solely up to him. But it wasn't. There were plenty of other people here in Manchir who definitely weren't inclined to leave well enough alone, and some of them were getting steadily louder and more vociferous. It seemed pretty obvious to Charles that sooner or later, if they had their way, people were going to have to choose up sides, and if he had to do that, he knew which side he was going to choose. Whatever had started the quarrel between Coruscant and Carus, he didn't need any dirty foreigners poking any sticks into hornets' nests here in his hometown. And they had to be dirty foreigners, didn't they? After all foreigners were, weren't they?
Blasphemers! He shouted again.
Blasphemers!
He heard someone else shouting. It wasn't one of his friends this time either. Others were starting to take up the cry, and Charles grinned as he reached under his tunic and loosened the short, heavy cudgel in his belt.
That's enough!
Rather to Patrick Henry's surprise, the voice of the young Carisian officer in front of the cathedral was actually audible through the crowd noise. It probably helped that he was using a leather speaking trumpet, but more likely, Henry reflected, it had to do with the fact that he'd been trained to be heard through the thunder of a field of battle. What surprised him even more was that the front ranks of his crowd...
No, mob, not crowd, he thought. Let's use the honest word, Patrick.
Actually seemed to hesitate. His eyes widened slightly as he saw it, then narrowed again as he recognized at least part of the reason. The Carisian had raised his voice to be heard, true, but it wasn't a bellow of answering anger. No, it was a voice of exasperation. And the young man's body language wasn't especially belligerent either. In fact, he had one hand on his hip, and it looked as if he were actually tapping his toe on the cathedral steps.
He looks more like an irritated tutor somewhere than an army officer confronting a hostile mob, Henry realized.
It's Wednesday morning, the Carisian went on. You should all be ashamed of yourselves. If you're not in church yourselves, the least you can do is let other people go to Mass in peace.
What do you know about Mass, heretic?
Somebody, he thought it might have been Emil, shouted back.
I know I'm not going to throw rocks through a cathedral's windows, the Carisian shouted back. I know that much.
He gave a visible shudder.
Langhorne only knows what my mother would do to me if she found out about that.
More than one person in the crowd surprised Henry, and probably themselves, by laughing. Others only snarled, and there was at least a spatter of additional shouts and curses as Archbishop Clermont passed through the cathedral doors behind the Marines.
Go home!
The Carisian's raised voice sounded almost friendly, tinged more with resignation than anger.
If you have a point to make, make it someplace else, on a day that doesn't belong to God. I don't want to see anybody hurt on a Wednesday. In fact, my orders are to avoid that if I possibly can. But my orders are also to protect the cathedral and anyone in it. And if I have to hurt someone outside it to do that, I will.
His voice was considerably harder now, still that of someone trying to be reasonable, but with an undertone that warned them all there was a limit to his patience. Henry glanced around the faces of the four or five men closest to him and saw them looking back at him. One of them raised an eyebrow and twitched his head back the way they'd come, and Henry nodded very slightly. He wasn't afraid of going toe-to-toe with the Marines himself, but Father Adrian had made it clear that it was Henry's job to nurture and direct the anti-Carus resistance. That resistance might well require martyrs in days to come, yet it would need leaders just as badly. Possibly even more badly. The man who'd raised the eyebrow nodded back and turned away, forging a path towards the front of the now stalled crowd. Henry watched him go for a moment, then he and several of the others began filtering towards the back.
Damn me if I don't think the lad's going to do it, Platoon Sergeant McGee thought wonderingly.
The sergeant wouldn't have bet a single Harchong mark on Lieutenant Tallis's being able to talk the mob into turning around and going home, but Tallis had obviously hit a nerve by reminding them all it was Wednesday. McGee had expected that to backfire, given the shouts of blasphemer and heretic coming out of the crowd. Yet it would appear the lieutenant had read its mood better than he had.
Go on now,
Tala said, his tone gentler as the mob's volume began to decrease and he could lower his own voice level a bit. Disperse before anyone gets hurt. I don't want that. For that matter, whether you believe it or not, Emperor Caleb doesn't want that. Archbishop Claremont doesn't want that. And as for damn sure, if you'll pardon my language, that God doesn't want that. So what say you and I make all those people happy? Charles Dobbins grimaced as he felt the mood of the crowd around him shift. Somehow, this wasn't what he'd anticipated. This Carisian officer, Charles had no idea how to read the man's rank insignia, was supposed to be furious, screaming at them to disperse, threatening them, making his contempt for them clear. He certainly wasn't supposed to be just talking to them. And reasoning with them, or pretending he was at any rate, was just too underhanded and devious to be believed. And yet, Charles wasn't completely immune to the Carisian's manner. And the other man had a point about its being Wednesday. Not only that, but the Carisian's mention of his mother had reminded Charles forcibly of his own mother, and how she was likely to react when she found out what her darling boy had been up to when he was supposed to be at Mass himself. He didn't know what thoughts were going through the minds of the rest of the crowd, but he could sense the way the entire mob was settling back on its heels, losing the forward momentum which had carried it down the street. Some of the people in it, including some of Charles's friends, were still shouting, yet their voices had lost much of their fervor. They sounded shriller, more isolated, as if those voices' owners felt their own certainty oozing away. Charles took his hand away from the truncheon under his tunic and was a bit surprised to discover he was actually more relieved than regretful at the way things had so unexpectedly shifted. He started to turn away, then paused, his eyes widening in shock, as the man who'd just walked up behind him brought something out from under his own tunic. Charles had never seen one of the new flintlocks which had been introduced into the Coruscantian army, but he recognized what he had to be seeing now. It was a short, squat weapon, a musket whose stock had been cut down and whose barrel had been sawn down to no more than a couple of feet. It was still far bigger and clumsier than the pistols which equipped the Carisian Imperial Guard, and it must have been extraordinarily difficult to keep it hidden. But the flintlock, which had been fitted in place of its original matchlock, didn't need the clumsy, smoldering, impossible-to-hide lit slow match. That had probably helped a lot where concealing it was concerned, a corner of Charles's mind thought almost calmly. He watched, frozen, as the weapon rose. It poked over the shoulder of another young man, no more than a year or so older than Charles himself, standing beside him. The other young man twitched in astonishment, turning his head, looking across and down at the muzzle as it intruded into the corner of his field of vision, just as the man holding it squeezed the trigger. The sudden gunshot took everyone by surprise, even experienced non-coms like Waston and McGee. Perhaps it shouldn't have taken the sergeants unaware, but Tallis's obvious success in calming the crowd had lulled even them just a bit as well. The man behind that musket had marked the Marine lieutenant as his target. Fortunately for Brad Tallis, however, no one would ever have described the would-be murderer's weapon as a precision instrument. It was a smoothbore with a very short barrel and loaded with meal powder, not corned powder. Less than a quarter of the slow-burning, anemic propellant had actually been consumed before the rest was flung out of the barrel in a huge, blinding cloud, and the bullet's flight could only be characterized as erratic. The unfortunate young man who'd been looking at the muzzle at the moment it was fired screamed in agony as his face was savagely burned. He staggered back, clutching at his permanently blinded eyes, and four or five more people who'd been unlucky enough to be standing directly in front of him cried out in pain of their own as blazing flakes of gunpowder seared coal miners' tattoos into the backs of their necks. One especially luckless soul actually had his hair set on fire and went to his knees, howling in panic and pain as he beat at the flames with both hands. Charles Dobbins was far enough away to escape with only minor singeing, and his head snapped around, looking for the musket's target.
Shit!
Lieutenant Tallis wondered if Platoon Sergeant McGee even realized he'd spoken out loud. The single word was pitched almost conversationally, after all. Not that it was going to make a lot of difference. The musket ball had almost certainly been meant for him, the lieutenant realized, but it hadn't found him. Instead, it had slammed into the chest of one of his privates, a good 4 feet to his right. The Marine went down, clutching at the front of his suddenly bloody tunic, and Tallis realized something else. Major Porter's orders had been perfectly explicit on the matter of what Tallis was supposed to do if firearms or edged weapons were used against any of his troops.
"Fix bayonets!"
he heard his own voice command, and the men of his platoon obeyed. He saw many of those in the crowd suddenly trying to back away as steel clicked and the long shining blades sprouted from the ends of his Marines' rifles. Some of them managed it, others found their escape blocked by the mass of bodies behind them, and still others reacted quite differently. Expressions snarled, truncheons and clubs came out from under tunics, and the front of the mob seemed to solidify somehow, drawing together. It seemed clear the people in those front ranks were ready for a fight.
For now, Brad Tallis thought grimly. For now, perhaps.
He looked at his bleeding private, and his jaw tightened as his expression hardened into something far less youthful than his years. He'd seen dead men enough at Talbor Pass. He looked away again, meeting McGee's eye, and his youthful voice was a thing of hammered iron.
"Sergeant McGee, clear the street," he said.
2. Michael Berg, Duchy of Eastshire, Kingdom of Chisholm. So, General Sir Kint Claraik, Imperial Carisian Army, late Brigadier Claraik of the Imperial Carisian Marines, and recently knighted and ennobled as the Baron of Green Valley, said, as he poured wine into his guest's cup, "What do you think, Sajan Merlin?" "Of what, my lord?" the tall, blue-eyed Imperial Guardsman, in the black and gold of the House of Armagh, asked mildly. He picked up his cup and sipped appreciatively. Claraik's taste in wine had always been good, and his promotion hadn't changed the ex-marine in that respect, or in any other respect that Merlin Athrawis could see. He was still the same competent officer he'd always been, with the same willingness to roll up his sleeves and dig into a new assignment. The tent in which they currently sat while icy autumn rain pounded down against its nominally waterproofed canvas canopy was evidence of that. The day after tomorrow would be Caleb and Charlian Armagh's first anniversary, which also made it the anniversary of the creation of the Empire of Caris, and Merlin couldn't help comparing the chill, wet misery outside Green Valley's tent to the brilliant sunshine, tropical heat, and flowers of that wedding day. The difference was pronounced, and while Green Valley might be a mere baron, and one of the Empire's most recently created peers to boot, he'd held his new title for less than 4 or 5 days, after all. It was no secret Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian both thought very highly of him. In fact, it was no secret that he'd been hauled back to Chisholm from the newly conquered, more or less, Princedom of Coruscant, precisely because of how highly they regarded him. Given all of that, one might reasonably have assumed that a man with his connections could have found comfortable quarters in the nearby city of Michaelburg, rather than ending up stuck under canvas with winter coming on quickly. And a northern winter at that, Merlin thought dryly, glancing at the large, dripping spot in one corner of the tent, where its roof's theoretical waterproofing had proved unequal to the heavy rain. "He's a southern boy when all's said and done, and he's not going to enjoy winter in Chisholm one bit. The rain's bad enough, but there's worse coming. Snow? What's that?" Which, as Merlin understood perfectly well, was the real reason Green Valley had taken up residence in this tent, instead of a luxurious townhouse, or at least a comfortable room in one of the city's more respectable inns. An awful lot of other Carizian ex-Marines were about to spend a Chisholmian winter under less than ideal conditions, and Green Valley wouldn't be moving out of his tent until the last man under his command had been provided with dry, warm space of his own in the barracks being hastily thrown up. "Of what is it?" the general repeated now, sitting back in his folding camp chair beside the cast-iron stove, which was doing its best, successfully at the moment, to maintain a fairly comfortable temperature inside the tent. "Now let me see. What could I possibly have been asking about? He frowned in obvious, difficult thought, scratching his chin with his eyes screwed half shut, and Merlin chuckled. There weren't all that many people on the planet of Safehold who felt comfortable enough with the fearsome Sajin Merlin to give him grief, and he treasured the ones who did. "All right, my lord." He acknowledged defeat with a grin, then let the grin fade slowly. "Actually," he went on in a considerably more serious tone, "I've been impressed. You and Duke Eastshare seem to be managing the integration process even more smoothly and quickly than their majesties had anticipated. It's my impression that you're basically comfortable with the emerging command relationships as well?" His tone made the final sentence a question, and Green Valley snorted. "I'd expected a somewhat more visionary comment out of you, Merlin," he said. "In fact, I'm a little surprised His Majesty felt it was necessary to send you all the way up here to look things over with your own eyes, as it were." Merlin managed not to wince, although that was coming to the point with a vengeance. On the other hand, it was a reasonable enough observation, given that Green Valley was one of the relatively small number of people who knew Sajin Merlin was far more than merely Emperor Caleb Armok's personal armsman and bodyguard. Over the last few years, virtually everyone in what had become the Empire of Karras had learned that all of the old fables and fairy tales about the legendary Sajin warrior monks were not only true, but actually understated their lethality. There was absolutely no question in anyone's mind that Sajin Merlin was the most deadly bodyguard any Carizian monarch had ever possessed. Given the number of assassination attempts he'd thwarted, and not just on the Emperor, it was no wonder he was kept constantly at Caleb's back, watching over him, protecting him, both in the council chamber and on the field of battle. But what Green Valley knew, and very few of his fellow Carizians even suspected, was that Caleb and Charlian had another and very special reason for keeping Merlin so close. The Sajin had visions. He could see and hear far distant events, know what was happening thousands of miles away, even as it happened. His ability to literally sit in on the war councils and political deliberations of Karras's enemies was a priceless advantage for the beleaguered empire, and his role as Caleb's bodyguard was a perfect cover. He truly was the deadly and efficient guardian everyone thought he was, but that very deadliness provided ample reason for his permanent proximity to Caleb and Charlian. After all, not even a Sajin could protect someone from an assassin if he wasn't there to do the protecting, now could he? And so any potentially suspicious souls understood exactly why Captain Athrawes, with his eyes of unearthly Sajin blue, was constantly at the Emperor's elbow, and it obviously had nothing at all to do with visions. Merlin was a bodyguard, not an advisor and an oracle. Any village idiot could figure that much out. Green Valley knew better than that. Indeed, he'd come to suspect that Merlin was as much mentor as advisor, that most of the radical innovations which had provided the margin, so far, for Karras's survival in the face of its enemies' overwhelming numerical advantages had come from the Sajin's suggestions to the Carisians, who had actually developed them into workable propositions. The Baron suspected that for the excellent reason that he'd been one of those Carisians. It had been Green Valley, as a major in the Royal Carisian Marines, who'd played the lead role in developing revolutionary new infantry tactics built around the field artillery and rifled flintlock muskets, which had just happened to appear in Karras shortly after one Merlin Athrawes's arrival. He'd worked closely with Merlin in the process of accomplishing that task, and they'd worked even more closely together in many ways during the Coruscant campaign. In fact, the victory which had won Green Valley his title and his knighthood and sealed Prince Hector of Coruscant's defeat had been possible only because Merlin had revealed his ability to see visions to him. And so, yes, Baron Green Valley knew far more than the vast majority of his fellow subjects about Merlin Athrawes. But what he didn't know, what Merlin devoutly hoped he didn't even suspect, was how much more Merlin truly was. "I'd really like to get him added to the inner circle," the Sajin reflected, "and I know Caleb and Charlian both agree with me too. In fact, I think we have to get him added. It simply doesn't make sense not to bring him all the way inside, and I don't think we have to worry about any crises of religious conscience on his part." That last thought really did almost make him wince, given its direct bearing on the reason he was here. "Their Majesties actually sent me for several reasons, my lord," he said. "One of them, in many ways, probably the most important, was to let me evaluate your progress, yours and Duke Eastshare's, I mean, firsthand. When I can actually ask questions, maybe even make a few suggestions in His Majesty's name. It's hard to do that if all you're doing is watching a vision." "I can see where that would be true," Green Valley agreed. He didn't seem at all upset by the notion of Merlin's evaluating his progress in his new assignment, the Sajin noted. "And the second reason, almost equally important," Merlin admitted, "is to get me close enough to Eastshare to interact with him." This time, Green Valley only nodded. Merlin wasn't especially surprised. The Baron had always been an astute and diplomatic fellow. He understood that even with him, Merlin could scarcely come right out and say, "They want me to see whether or not Eastshare is a traitor, too." The good news was that Merlin was almost certain Eastshare wasn't. The bad news was that, despite all the Sajin's unfair advantages, Merlin was only almost certain he wasn't. And unfortunately, the fact that the Duke was effectively Empress Charlian's uncle by marriage, that he was the brother-in-law of the recently deceased Duke of Halbrook Hollow, and that he'd been Halbrook Hollow's senior general, second in command of the Royal Chisomian Army for the better part of 15 years, meant that almost certain wasn't nearly good enough. Not in the wake of Halbrook Hollow's treason.
"May I ask what your impressions have been so far?" Green Valley asked politely. "In a general sense, of course. I wouldn't want to ask you to get too specific about any particularly deserving ex-Marines, assuming there are any of those around, of course, and embarrass me with your effusive praise," he added, and Merlin snorted.
"You know, my lord," the Sajin said in an almost meditative tone, "I've always heard that a certain brashness, one might say, is an integral part of any Marine's personality. You wouldn't happen to know how that rumor might have gotten started, would you?"
"Me?" Green Valley widened his eyes innocently. "I'm not a Marine, Sajin Merlin. I'm an officer in the Imperial Army. In fact, I've got a written commission around here somewhere to prove it. So what would a bluff, honest, naturally modest army officer know about Marines and their overinflated self-images?
Oh, an excellent point, Merlin agreed. I can't imagine what could have come over me to ask such a question.
I should certainly hope not, Green Valley said a bit severely as he picked up the wine bottle and topped off Merlin's cup once more.
Well, at any rate, in answer to your question, my impressions so far have been just about universally good.
Merlin's tone and expression had both turned serious once again.
To be honest, I hadn't really realized quite how good the Chisomian army was. I should have, I suppose, given the role it played under King Salis. Not to mention keeping Queen Charlian on the throne, and alive, after Salis's death, of course. I mean, 2/3 of its senior officers are veterans of Salis's campaigns, after all. And it's obvious Eastshire, and Holbrook Hollow, for that matter, did an excellent job of training and equipping them in the first place.
Green Valley nodded slowly, his gaze thoughtful, and Merlin shrugged.
Obviously, he continued, their equipment hasn't been as good as what we took to Coruscant with us, but then no one's has when you come down to it. And, just as you've undoubtedly been discovering, their formations and drill are all oriented around tactics which have just become obsolete, but again, they're scarcely alone in that. Given the weapons available to everybody a few years ago, my impression is that Eastshire's troops could at least hold their own against any of the mainland armies, man for man, and probably kick their arses for them, for that matter. Except for Siddermark, of course.
It was Green Valley's turn to snort. The Republic of Siddermark's army was widely acknowledged, with good reason, as the most effective armed force in Safehold's history. On land, at least, Siddermark's navy was virtually non-existent, and the Royal Carisian Navy had reigned supreme upon Safehold seas even before Merlin Othrawes's arrival in Telesburg. Any place a Siddermarkian pike phalanx could find a place to stand, though, it reigned supreme. Which explained the Republic's successful, sustained expansion southward towards the Desnarian Empire over the past 150 Safeholdian years or so. That expansion had been halted only when the Knights of the Temple Lands guaranteed the frontiers of the Grand Duchy of Silcaia in the Treaty of Silktown in 869. Silcaia was at least nominally independent, although its Grand Duke paid a substantial yearly tribute to Desnair. He also paid one to the Knights of the Temple Lands every year, although that one was called a tithe and, until very recently, had been paid by every Safeholdian ruler. Not officially to the Knights of the Temple Lands, of course, but that was only because the Knights of the Temple Lands all just happened to be members of the Church of God Awaiting's Council of Vicars as well. Their dual role as both secular and temporal rulers gave them a significant unfair advantage, yet it imposed certain disadvantages as well, especially now. The Knights of the Temple Lands had been nervous for a long, long time about that magnificent Siddharmarkian army just on the other side of their shared frontier, and over the years they'd used their power as princes of the church to help discourage any adventurism on the part of a succession of the Republic's Knights Protector. The Treaty of Silktown might be the most flagrant example of their intervention, but it was scarcely the only one. That hadn't exactly helped the Church's relations with the Republic, although it had scarcely seemed likely to provoke an open breach, whatever some of the vicars might have thought, given the Church's unassailable supremacy. But now that the Church's supremacy had been assailed, all of the anxieties which had been entertained by decades of Church chancellors had just acquired an entirely new point. There was no real evidence of any general movement of Siddharmarkians to embrace the Church of Caris, yet that didn't keep the group of four, the quartet of powerful vicars who truly ruled the Church, from worrying about what might yet happen.
I wish it would happen, Merlin thought more than a bit wistfully. But however much Stonar resents the church, or the group of four at least, he's not about to climb out on a limb with Karis. I don't think it's because he disagrees with Karis's accusations of church corruption, or because he has any illusions about the sanctity of the group of four and their motivations. But he's pragmatic as hell, and as well aware of the balance of power as anyone. In fact, he's better aware of it than almost anyone else. Besides, from what I've seen, he doesn't think any move to break with the church would find general support in Sittermark. And for the moment at least, it looks like he's right about that.
The thing that impresses me most about the Chisomians, to be honest, the Sajan continued out loud, is how readily and smoothly they seem to be adopting to the new tactics. He raised one eyebrow at Green Valley, inviting comment, and the Baron nodded.
You're right about that, he agreed. It seems to me that their officers are grasping the reasons behind the new tactics even faster than our troops did. And they're not just going through the motions in order to keep their majesties happy. For that matter, they're not even just duplicating what we've got to teach them either. Instead, they're thinking about why we made the changes we've made, and looking for ways to make what we've already accomplished even more effective.
That's been my impression too, Merlin acknowledged.
As a matter of fact, I haven't seen a sign of what I was most worried about, Green Valley said.
Merlin's eyebrow rose again, and the Baron shrugged.
Karis has never had anything anyone in his right mind would call an army, Merlin. We had a navy, second to none, and nobody wanted to face our marines at sea. But in terms of anything a land power would describe as an army, Karis wasn't even on the map. Here in Chisholm, though, he continued, sitting back in his chair, his expression intent, the army's clearly the senior service. It was the army that broke the power of the great nobles and provided the stability here at home that let the Empress's father, and her in her turn, of course, build the kingdom's prosperity. King Salis may have started building a navy as soon as he could, since Chisholm needed it to protect its commerce against Coruscantian privateers, but it was only the prosperity created by the army which let him do that. So while we Carizians have tended to lavish our admiration and pride, not to mention the dragon's share of our wealth, on the navy, it's been the other way around in Chisholm.
He shrugged again.
Under those circumstances, what I was most afraid of was that the Chisholmians would automatically reject our advice about the new tactics. After all, what could a bunch of marines know about the real conditions and requirements of fighting a war on land? In a lot of ways, that would only have been a reasonable question, too. For that matter, I imagine more than a few Carizian naval officers felt exactly that way where the Chisholmian Navy was concerned, when you come down to it. And the fact that it was our marines who did all the actual fighting in Coruscant, that their army was completely left out sitting here at home, could very well have fanned their resentment. Oh, they said they accepted the logistics arguments, that they understood we could only supply so many men across so many miles of ocean, which meant we couldn't afford to take along anyone who wasn't already equipped and trained with the new weapons. But I was afraid that, whatever they might have said, they would have resented being treated like some kind of farm team and left sitting in the dugout while the big league players went off to war. As a matter of fact, that was what I expected to happen, and not just because of any petty concern about the army's honor either. You know as well as I do that prestige and the ability to point to past accomplishments play a big role in how big a budget an army or a navy can expect to see coming its way. This is a professional army with a professional officer corps, Merlin. They have to have been worried that being left home while someone else did all the fighting was going to adversely affect their career prospects, one might say. I've seen a distinct undertone of resentment out of quite a few civilian Chisomian bureaucrats, who seem to think Karis has gotten an unfair share of the power and advantages under the Empire. So I don't think it would have been unreasonable for the army to have felt that way.
I know, Merlin nodded. I've seen the same thing. From the bureaucrats, I mean. Although, for some strange reason, they seem a bit more leery about showing their resentment around the Emperor or the Empress.
No, really. I wonder why that might be, Green Valley mused with an innocent smile, and Merlin snorted. As I say, I really was concerned about the army's possible resentment over being left out of the Coruscant campaign, Green Valley went on. And I have seen a little bit of it, but not very much, thank Langhorne.
So they don't seem to be upset about the sudden infusion of all the Marines, either? Merlin asked. He was watching Green Valley attentively. The Baron had been chosen for his present assignment. Despite his relative youth, he was still well short of 40, and painfully new elevation to the aristocracy, not simply because he was so good at his job, but because of the acuity of his insights. Now, Green Valley gave the Sajan a wry headshake, as if admonishing him for having asked a question to which they both so obviously already knew the answer.
No, it hasn't, he said out loud. Partly, I think that's because of their professionalism. They're more interested in learning how to do their jobs even better than in defending their reputation for how well they already do them. In that respect, they remind me a lot of our naval officers like Earl Lock Island and Baron Rockpoint. They're professionals first and prima donnas second, or even third. But as I say, that's only part of the reason.
Green Valley's eyes were narrow now, his expression intent.
I think probably an even bigger reason is that, aside from its very uppermost ranks, such a huge percentage of the army's officers are commoners. One of the things I think most frustrates the great nobles who are so unhappy with the Emperor and the Empress is the way they've been shut out of any real positions of power in the army. It would be stupid of them to be surprised by that, I suppose, since the whole reason King Salis and Baron Green Mountain, and Holbrook Hollow, to give the man his due, created the Royal Army in the first place was to restore the Crown's prerogatives at the expense of the nobility. After the amount of fighting that took, I don't think it should astonish anyone that they decided against handing out generalships to any noblemen whose loyalty to the Crown they weren't totally sure of. And the fact that low-born soldiers could, and have, risen to high rank in the army helps explain how enthusiastically the commons support it. Here in Chisholm, the army holds exactly the same position, as far as the commons are concerned at any rate, as the navy does in Karis, and it's young enough and professional enough to be genuinely flexible.
He shook his head.
I honestly never expected just how flexible it really is.
Merlin nodded in agreement. He'd been a bit more optimistic about the Royal Chisomian Army's willingness to adopt the new weapons and tactics than some Carisians had been. But even he had been pleasantly surprised by the Chisomians' enthusiasm for the changes. And, the Sajan thought, Green Valley had an even better point than the Baron himself might realize about the army's importance in the eyes of the Empire's Chisomian subjects. By and large, the majority of Chisomians appeared firmly united behind the decision to fuse the kingdoms of Chisholm and Karis, now almost universally referred to as Old Karis, just to keep things straight, into the new Carisian Empire. Not all of them were, however. Some, and especially those who were most prone to think in terms of their own power and influence, doubted that the promised equality between Chisholm and Old Karis could or would truly be maintained. Old Karis boasted half again the population of Chisholm, and its economic wealth was at least four times that of Chisholm.
Its manufactories and merchants had held a dominant position in Chisholm's economy even before the two kingdoms had united. The Carisian merchant marine dominated all the seas and oceans of Safehold, and the Royal Chisholmian Navy had disappeared, almost without a trace, into the much larger Royal Carisian Navy, even if the resulting union was officially called the Imperial Navy. Under the circumstances, it probably wasn't unreasonable for at least some Chisholmians to nourish a few doubts about how long it would be before Chisholm openly became the junior partner, one might almost say the second-class partner, in the imperial relationship. Caleb and Charlian were determined to prevent that from happening. The fact that Charlian was Caleb's co-ruler, that she had governed the entire empire in her own name from Telesburg while Caleb was off at war in Coruscant, and that it was she, not Caleb, who had overseen the creation of the new imperial parliament, had gone quite some way towards accomplishing that goal. The fact that the imperial capital would be located in Cherraeth, the capital of the Kingdom of Chisholm, for half the year, and in Telesburg, the capital of the Kingdom of Carus, for the other half of the year, went even further. It assured the citizens of Chisholm that Carisian viewpoints would not be allowed to dominate the imperial government simply because the people arguing for those viewpoints enjoyed a far better, far closer, and uninterrupted access to the emperor and empress. The formation of the imperial army was intended to be yet another reassurance. The Chisholmian crown's two great supports under King Salus and Queen Charlian had been the fierce loyalty of the Chisholmian commons and the royal army. As Green Valley had just pointed out, it had been the army, backed by the political and financial support of the commons and with its ranks filled primarily by commoners, with which King Salus had broken the arrogant power of the Carisian aristocracy's great magnates. It was that same army and the even fiercer loyalty, the love, of those same commoners for the dauntless courage of the child queen who had succeeded Salus after his untimely death, which had allowed Charlian to survive. And those same deep reservoirs of support were what had carried them with her in her decision to wed Caleb and create the empire. She and Caleb were both fully aware of that, which was why, just as Caleb had insisted, Chisholmian merchants and manufacturers must have equal access to the empire's markets, both foreign and domestic. The two of them had decreed that it was Chisholm which would take the lead in the formation of the imperial army. There were those among the Royal Carisian Marines who had objected, although they'd been wise enough to do it quietly in most cases, to that decision. Whose sense of pride in their own organization, in the way it had grown so explosively, the fashion in which it had smashed its opposition in Coruscant, was deeply offended by the notion that the Marines should not only go back to being purely a shipboard and amphibious force, but also transfer the majority of the Coruscant campaign's veterans to the army. Those who'd been sufficiently foolish to make an issue of their objections had been found other duties, however. "I think probably still another part of it," the Sajan said out loud now, "is the fact that Caleb and Charlian have made it so abundantly clear that whereas Carus is reasonably going to take the lead where naval affairs are concerned, it only makes sense to give that same role to Chisholm where the army is concerned. Which is why you're an army officer now, of course. The decision to fold the bulk of the Imperial Marines over into the army and respect the seniority of the army's existing officers in the process wasn't an easy one, but Caleb and Charlian were right to insist on it, I think." "Absolutely." Green Valley's nod was more vigorous and emphatic than Merlin's had been. "The officers I'm working with obviously see that decision as proof their majesties meant what they said about the organization of the Empire's armed forces, especially after... well..." The Baron's voice trailed off on a most unusual note of something that was almost, Not quite, but almost, embarrassment. And Merlin smiled, without any trace of humor. Especially after the army's top commander conspired with the temple loyalists to murder, or at least kidnap, Charlian, you mean?
Well, yes, actually, Green Valley admitted.
He shook his head slightly.
Hard to blame them for worrying about it, really. In their place, I'd certainly have been afraid the Crown would entertain serious doubts about the army's basic reliability. Especially given how popular Halbrook Hollow was, with the common troopers, not just the officer corps. He's the one who built this entire army, Merlin. He shaped it. He commanded it in most of its critical battles. And he led its soldiers to victory in every campaign. How could they not have worried about whether or not the Crown would feel it couldn't afford to trust their loyalty after something like that? For that matter, a lot of them felt shamed by his actions. They hadn't done anything wrong, but he was their commander, and at least some of them feel his treason has stained them as well.
I know exactly what you mean, Merlin said soberly. And the truth is, he told himself silently, that at least some of the army's officers do entertain the same doubts Halbrook Hollow did. Like the noble Earl of Swale, for example.
Barca Roscale, the Earl of Swale, was young, only 37 Safeholdian years old. He was also very tall for a Safeholdian, within an inch or so of Merlin's own height, and rakishly good-looking with his fair hair, dark eyes, and sun-bronzed complexion. Back when Merlin Athrawes had been Nimue Alban, she would definitely have given Swale a close look. But in addition to his good looks and noble birth, Swale was a dyed-in-the-wool temple loyalist. He'd done a better job of hiding it than quite a few of his fellows, including Halbrook Hollow. But Merlin had no doubts about his fundamental beliefs. What he didn't know yet was where Swale's ultimate loyalties lay. Would his repulsion against the Church of Caris's apostasy and heresy, and quite possibly the death in disgrace of an army commander he deeply admired and respected, drive him into treason of his own? Or would his and his family's long-standing loyalty to the House of Tate, unusual, actually, among the high Chisomian nobility, and his oath as an officer of the Royal Army hold firm against those forces? Merlin was afraid he could guess which way Swale would jump in the end. But he hadn't jumped yet, and neither Caleb nor Charlian was in the habit of punishing people for what they might do, which suited Merlin Athrawes just fine when it came down to it. I'm keeping an eye on all of the ones we know shared at least some of Halbrook Hollow's doubts, he reminded himself. And if Caleb and Charlian aren't going to hammer anyone until and unless someone decides to emulate Halbrook Hollow, they won't hesitate if the time ever comes to bring that hammer down either. I know they hope they won't have to, but they'll do it if they do have to. And at least it looks like the ones with temple loyalist leanings are definitely in the minority, for now. And Duke Eastshire? He asked out loud. What's your read of how he feels about all this, my lord?
You're asking me to comment about my commanding officer, Sajan Merlin, Green Valley said, with a sudden and unaccustomed edge of severity, and he frowned. I understand why you'd be concerned, but to be honest, I don't think it's really appropriate for me to be passing judgment on his grace's loyalty to the crown.
Merlin allowed one of his eyebrows to arch in mild surprise. He started to respond, then stopped. Actually, he thought, Green Valley's stiffness was a judgment on Eastshire's loyalty. Particularly since it clearly didn't stem from any reluctance to risk antagonizing a powerful noble in the extraordinarily unlikely event that word of any criticism on his part would ever make it back to Eastshire.
What it is an indication of just how much he's discovered he respects Eastshire, Merlin told himself. If he had any doubts about Eastshire's loyalty, he wouldn't respect him either, no matter how flexible the Duke might be in a professional sense. So the fact that he doesn't want to answer is an answer. I understand, my lord, he said out loud, rather more formally than had become the norm for his conversations with Green Valley. The Baron looked at him for a moment, then gave an almost imperceptible nod, and his frown vanished. So, overall, you're satisfied? Merlin continued in a more normal tone, and Green Valley nodded again more firmly. Overall, I'm very satisfied. I wish, and so does Duke Eastshire, that we could have provided even more marines as cadre, but we both understand why their majesties had to leave General Cherman a big enough garrison force in Coruscant. I also wish we could get the new rifle shops and cannon foundries set up here in Chisholm more quickly, but Chisholm simply doesn't have the pool of experienced mechanics and craftsmen old Carus does. At least the first couple of shipments of rifles have already come in, so not everyone is drilling with broom handles. On the plus side, in addition to everything else we've just been talking about, I have to admit that the Duke and his officers seem to have a better grasp of the realities of fighting on land than I do, and I'm the fellow who developed all our new infantry tactics, he snorted. They pay me a flattering amount of attention, and they listen damned carefully to everything I say, particularly given the fact that, unlike them, I actually have field experience with the new weapons. But the truth is, they've already pointed out a lot of places where my ideas, and not just about tactics either, they've got a lot more experience with army logistics than we have, could stand some improving. In some cases, a lot of improving. And it says very good things about you, my lord, that you not only recognize the truth when you see it, but that you're willing to admit it to others, and not just yourself too, Merlin thought. So you think I'll be able to go back to Chiraeth and tell their majesties the great army integration project is going well? He said out loud. Yes, Green Valley said, looking steadily into the Sajan's blue eyes, making it plain just how many levels he was actually speaking on. Yes, I think you can tell them it's going very well.